Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Barack Obama's early years set the course for his future, and what is the legacy of his very diverse ancestors? Obama's cool detachment in public tends to impress his admirers and irritate his critics. And as my guest today writes in a new biography of the president's youth, it seems to be the product of a life spent as an eternal outsider, adept at watching and learning from others in a variety of situations, while rarely fitting entirely into any particular circle. Pulitzer Prize winner David Marinus is associate editor for The Washington Post and author of the new book, Barack Obama, The Story. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
You take a really interesting approach here in going back several generations into his family history before Barack Obama was even born. Talk about why you felt like that was important, in particular in this story, in getting a good understanding of who this man is.
Well, I have to preface that by saying that, in part, I wasn't just writing a book to try to explain Barack Obama. That the fascination that got me into the book was the world that created him, and the randomness of his creation, and the chance, the opportunity through his family story to write about the modern world. So even though it's labeled as a biography, I consider it a multi-generational story, and that was really what drew me into it. And the second aspect to it is, given the contradictions that he faced from his birth, how he resolved them and figured himself out. So the book is an attempt to be the world that created him, and then how Barack Obama recreated himself. And I think that even as I was interested in the family history in and of itself, it also offered many ways to illuminate his life and the way he thinks and acts.
Yeah, in so many ways, this story, David, is one. It's almost like the existence of this abundance of life we have on Earth. There are a variety of sort of happy accidents along the way that could have gone either direction.
You know, I think that's true of all of us, but perhaps with the Obama story, it's just a little more unusual. Absolutely, both from both sides of the story, from Kenya, the developments that made it possible for the president's father, Barack Obama Sr., to reach Hawaii in 1959, and from the Kansas side of the story, what took the Dunham family and their young daughter, 17-year-old Stanley Ann Dunham, to Hawaii in 1960, and how those two stories intersected very, very briefly to create a future president of the United States is quite something. And there are so many moments along the way on both sides that made it possible. You know, for instance, just on the Kenya side, Barack Obama Sr. was in Nairobi working for a evangelical Christian woman named Betty Mooney, who was in Kenya to spread the gospel and literacy. And he was helping her translate some of her literacy books into his tribal language, the Luo language. And it was in her offices that she showed him a copy of the Saturday Evening Post with a story about the University of Hawaii. And it's multicolored beauty queens. You know, there was a photograph of seven different beauty queens from, you know, Polynesian and Japanese and Chinese and so on. And it impressed him because all he had read about the United States were the racial troubles in the late 1950s. And he thought maybe Hawaii would be a different sort of place. So that one article in the Saturday Evening Post unwittingly helped create all of this.
It's interesting, too, that we get hung up in this country on congratulating white people for, being fine with the idea of intermarrying and relationships with people of color. But it goes the other way as well. And you tell some interesting stories about Barack Obama's paternal grandfather and his unusual relationship to race, particularly given the environment in which he lived.
I'm sorry, did you say paternal or maternal?
Paternal, excuse me.
Paternal. Yeah, well, the paternal grandfather, Hussein Onyango, grew up in western Kenya and was really the first of his tribe, the Luo, his wave of his generation, the first to be westernized in many ways. And so he learned English from the missionaries out there and started to adopt some British airs about him, including taking tea, but at the same time was a very conflicted person who converted to Islam, although he was never a devout Muslim, and was was a little bit concerned about his own son's dealings in the West. I think that in his memoir, Barack Obama writes that it was the paternal grandfather who was most critical of the marriage between Barack Obama Sr. and Stanley Ann Dunham, President Obama's parents. But I'm not sure that that's so, though, honestly, Chris. I raised some doubts about how much he interfered or whether that was just part of the family mythology.
Let's talk about that mythology, because there is a bit of untangling you do here in terms of the story that Barack Obama himself perpetuated in his memoir, particularly about his father's side of the family, but not exclusively.
Yeah, no, it's on all sides. And when you know, any of your listeners think about it, if a biographer were to come along and perhaps try to unravel the realities of their family stories told to them by their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, you know, the difference between the stories and the reality might be pretty clear. So I think that all of us, to some degree, pass along family mythologies. In Obama's memoir, he writes that paternal grandfather I talked about, Hussein Onyango, was imprisoned and tortured by the British during the early stages of the Mau Mau Rebellion in Kenya. I hold out a possibility that happened, but I don't think it did, based on 6 interviews I did with people who knew the grandfather, and said it did not happen. There are no documents to show that it happened, although the British destroyed most of those documents. But in any case, I think it's part of the family mythology. Similarly, when President Obama was a young boy of 6, 7, and 8, he had a stepfather named Lolo Sitoro when his mother remarried to an Indonesian. And that family story was that the grandfather on the Indonesian side had been killed as a martyr fighting against the Dutch in their revolution in Indonesia. And in fact, I found out that his death was much more prosaic. He died falling off a stool, changing the drapes in his living room.
It's fascinating that Barack Obama ended up living for a significant part of his childhood with his grandparents, because
yes,
it turns out to have been a sort of pattern in the family.
Yes. My book begins with the suicide of a woman named Ruth Armour Dunham, who was the mother of President Obama's grandfather, Stanley Dunham. So Stan, when he was a young man, went to live with his grandparents in El Dorado, Texas, after his mother committed suicide. One of the remarkable things about young Stan Dunham in El Dorado, Kansas, was that also at that house, along with his grandparents, was his great-grandfather, Christopher Columbus Clark, who fought for the Missouri militia in the Civil War for the North. So in that one person's existence, it stretches back to the Civil War and then forward to the first African-American president of the United States. But yes, Stan Dunham grew up with his grandparents, and then when he was a grandfather, he helped raise Barry Obama, as President Obama was called in his childhood.
How did the relationship between Obama's grandparents seem to him when he was a child?
Well, his grandfather, Stan Dunham, I call some combination of Walter Mitty and Willie Loman. He was a salesman. He sold furniture and insurance. He was constantly telling stories, most of which were apocryphal. The way he wooed his wife, Madeline, was by telling her that he'd gone out to California after high school and become a writer and knew John Steinbeck and William Saroyan, and that he had a bunch of writings in his trunk. Later, when Madeline's younger brother, Charles, who was suspicious, opened that trunk, he found that there was nothing really there. And that was sort of typical of Stan Dunham. You know, he deserves credit for being, in his own way, a loving grandfather who tried to help his biracial grandson as best he could. But he wasn't a particularly a role model. He liked to drink and go to pool halls and have a good time. And it was really the grandmother, Madeline, who became the rock of the family. And she rose from being a secretary at a bank to being a vice president. So the relationship was, they in that era, there was no thought of divorce. The grandparents held together, but there was some tension in it.
It's notable, given the generations in which, you know, they spent their adulthood, that she was so active in work. And I suppose part of that was she needed to help support the family. But he was raised by strong women.
Yeah, he really was raised by strong women. And Madeline is fascinating to me, the grandmother, because her first heroine was Betty Davis. And she wanted to be, you know, she didn't want to be trapped and confined in small town Kansas. And she longed for some sort of sophistication that she saw in Betty Davis on the big screen. So she started smoking cigarettes with a cigarette holder and sort of changed her voice a little bit to sound more like Betty Davis. But she couldn't live that glorified life because she married Stan Dunham, who wasn't particularly reliable source of income. So she became the rock of the family from a fairly early age. And when people wonder, where did Barack Obama get the money to go to the schools he went to, or how did he get into Punahou, the elite prep school in Honolulu, and go to Occidental in Columbia, the grandmother was a central part of all that. She provided a lot of the money for him and was really very, very supportive of Barack Obama from his childhood on.
How would you characterize the relationship between Madeline and Stanley Dunham and their daughter, Stanley Ann Dunham?
Well, it was a little bit volatile, especially the relationship between Stan Dunham, the grandfather, and Ann, Stanley Ann, his daughter, the president's mother. She thought he was a storyteller and not particularly a reliable father and sort of full of it when he was talking to her friends. And she'd sort of roll her eyes whenever her dad was around her friends. And, you know, they were not alienated, but it wasn't a particularly close relationship, even though she relied on Stan, her dad, and her mother to help raise her son. I don't think he never visited her for all the time she lived in Indonesia, which says something.
We should say her unusual name was not because her father wanted a boy.
No, I mean, one of the fascinating things I found out, you would assume that a woman, someone named Stanley Ann Dunham, whose father's name is Stanley, was the unfortunate subject of a father who wanted a boy and didn't get one, so imposed that name on the daughter. But going back to what I said about the mother loving the screen actress Betty Davis, it was really Betty Davis who was responsible for Stanley Ann Dunham getting her name. In 1942, a couple of months before Stanley Ann Dunham was born, Betty Davis was in a movie which came to the Augusta Theater in Augusta, Kansas, where Madeline lived, and the character in that movie was named Stanley, a female. So that really inspired the name.
So Ann Dunham goes off to college very quickly, finds herself pregnant, and marries the elder Barack Obama. Do you have the sense that they were ever in love?
Well, I have a sense that she fell for him madly. Ann Dunham, Stanley Ann Dunham, again, like her mother, did not want to be confined and was looking for something more in the world. And so she gets to the University of Hawaii. She's only 17 years old. Her father wouldn't let her go elsewhere because of her age. And she's bright and sardonic and wants to be worldly. And in a Russian class, she encounters this brilliant, charismatic African and fell for him. But I don't think there was ever much of a relationship. And as a matter of fact, although they got married, they really did not live together.
David Marinus is my guest. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning associate editor for The Washington Post and author of the new book, Barack Obama, The Story. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with David Marinus about his new book, Barack Obama, The Story. David is a Pulitzer Prize-winning associate editor for The Washington Post. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. David, what sort of story did Ann Dunham give Barack Obama to help him make sense of the absence of his biological father throughout most of his childhood?
Well, much of it was understandable protective mythology. So, you know, he had enough to deal with as a biracial kid in Hawaii. And she told him she didn't want him to feel negatively toward his father. And so she told him essentially that the family broke up because he had to go to graduate school at Harvard and they could not afford to bring her and Barry along. I found to be not a true story, that in fact he did get a scholarship to Harvard as well as some other places, and they'd never really lived together even after they got married, that she in fact had taken her infant son and gone back to suburban to Seattle, where she had gone to high school and enrolled in extension courses at the University of Washington. She also told him that Barack Sr. was a brilliant man. That's where he got his brains, which is true. Not that he got his brains solely from his father, but he was brilliant. But she did not tell him, in fact, how very troubled he was, that he was both an alcoholic and abusive.
Abusive to her? Do you have evidence of that?
You know, I don't have any evidence of that, so I don't say it in the book. But the most people who are experts in that field say that someone who is abusive is not a one-time abuser. And I did spend a lot of time with Obama Sr.'s third wife, who was also an American, Ruth Baker Indesanjo. I interviewed her in Nairobi, where she had moved after she married Barack Obama Sr. In the 1960s, and she told me some horrific stories about his physical abuse of her.
One could certainly make too much of Obama's mother's profession in terms of how he saw the world, but you think it's safe to say that at least her approach to understanding how other people ticked probably rubbed off on herself?
Oh, I think that's definitely true. I think that the better side of his nature, his conscience, his empathy, is whatever one sees about him attempting to look at the world through other people's eyes, comes from his mother. She was an anthropologist and also later active in the microfinance movement and really devoted her life to trying to understand and help women artisans in the third world survive in a male-dominated culture. And I think that as an anthropologist, she was a very sharp observer, and I think you see that in her son. I'm not sure that rubbed off directly from her, but it is a characteristic that he also has. And she was a pretty good writer who wrote a long thesis, and he's also a writer and has that sort of writer's sensibility of looking at the world as an observer.
Did he ever have a sense that she was sort of observing him in the same way she would one of his subjects?
You know, I've never been asked that question before, and I don't think that he had that sense. I think that his view of his mother is fascinating, but it's a little different than that. I think that at once he knew that she was his conscience, but he also felt that she was naive, mm-hmm. That she had a sort of a naive liberal perspective on the world that sometimes didn't take into account the harsh realities. And I think that from his perspective, I could see why he would think that, because she did indeed try to protect him when he was a boy from some of the harsh realities of the world. When you look at her life separate from her son, you don't see that as much. She was pretty practical in her dealings in a very difficult environment in Indonesia, trying to help women there.
So to a certain extent, if he was able to see her as naive, she pulled it off.
Yes, she did. And he believed that and portrayed her that way in his own memoir. I think that that one of the interesting aspects of their relationship is that, you know, because she was gone for large chunks of his adolescence and teenage years when he was in high school in Honolulu and he was living with his grandparents, as much as there was love between mother and son, I think he was angry about it as well for periods of time that she wasn't there. And, you know, in his own memoir, the title, Dreams from My Father, and the story itself accentuates a father who was never there and diminishes to some degree the mother's role. And I think after that book came out, he felt some measure of guilt about that.
So, David, if you had to be a biracial kid in America in the early 70s, it turns out that Honolulu was not the worst place to do that. It was not a place where race was as set and as defined by outside forces as in the mainland United States.
No, that's certainly true. I think that in almost every respect but one, it was the luckiest place he could have grown up as a biracial kid, because in Hawaiian, people are called hapa if they're half one race and half another, and his childhood was full of hapas. You know, many of his classmates were part Chinese or Japanese or Okinawan or Portuguese or Polynesian or Haole, which is the word for Anglos. And you know, one of his high school buddies' name was Tom Topolinski. Sounds Polish. He was Chinese. So it was that sort of place, which certainly made it easier for Barack Obama. And many of the names, even on the island, had a similar rhythm to Barack Obama. You know, there was Ohanas and Olanas. And so there was nothing truly alien about his name or anything about him, except that there weren't that many African Americans in Honolulu. And those that were there were mostly attached to the military bases. So in that sense, you know, the school he went to had two or three African Americans. Not much for him to pick up on, and he had to sort of teach himself African American culture.
Yeah, and he seems to have approached that almost in an intellectual sense, because that was all that was available to him at a certain age.
Yes, definitely. I mean, he lived with his white mother and then with his white grandparents. So even though from the day he was born, he had to deal with race in America because of the color of his skin, and certainly endured a few racist moments in his childhood. Nonetheless, he really knew nothing about African-American culture and had to learn that on his own. His first entree into that was actually basketball, which was perhaps the major obsession of his high school years. He played on the high school team, and from the age 10, he played just about every day. And basketball is sort of the city game, an urban game, and his heroes were black athletes, Dr. J, Julius Erving, and Tiny Archibald and others. And the University of Hawaii basketball team had a lot of African-Americans from the mainland. So it was really from that he started to sort of delve into African-American culture.
And at that point, he was certainly a bright kid, and people recognized that, but he was an unremarkable student.
Very much so. Smart, not particularly applying himself in school, able to do well without studying too much or working too hard. More interested in basketball and smoking dope as part of his buddies in what they called the Chum Gang. Complete opposite, I would say, of another subject I've written a biography about, Bill Clinton, mm-hmm. who in high school in Hot Springs High ran for every possible office until everybody was sick of it. And his principal had to come to him when he was a senior and said, Billy, you know, you can't run for class president. You've dominated everything. We just don't want you to do that. And so he said, okay, I'll run for class secretary, you know, which he did, and ran against a girl and lost and wouldn't talk to her for weeks. I mean, Obama was not like that at all. He see no inkling political inclinations in high school, just barely a little bit in college. And it wasn't until much later when he was in Chicago as a community organizer that he sort of started to study power and its uses and thought about a life in politics.
There's something I think appealing there to all of us who were not necessarily precocious children and teenagers and young adults. We think these days that unless someone shows extraordinary ability in childhood, they'll just sort of lead a run-of-the-mill life. And Obama is an example of, you know, people sort of coming into their full fruition as time goes by.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think that there are more people like Obama than the other sort, but you know, in a lot of professions, the stars in high school don't become the stars later in life, and vice versa. So I don't think he's extraordinary in that sense, but for a lot of politicians, you see this sort of urge that came early and dominated their lives. So in that sense, he is refreshing that it wasn't there that early.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Eric on the line in Louisville. Hey, Eric.
Hey, how you doing, ma'am? And how you doing, sir?
We're doing well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good. Really enjoy this segment that you all having. But the question that I want to ask, I kind of heard it briefly, you know, with his different backgrounds and, you know, his father being of African descent and his mother, wasn't she of Irish descent, if I'm not mistaken?
Well, many, you know, a vast mix of different ethnicities, Irish, French, English, Scottish.
Okay. The question that I want to ask, with him, you know, going to, I think he graduated at the top of his class from Harvard Law School, or was it Harvard or Columbia?
Well, he went to Harvard Law School, and Columbia is where he got his undergraduate degree. And
okay.
He wasn't at the top of his class, but he was at Harvard. He was elected president of the Harvard Law Review, which is an incredibly elite position, sort of the most prestigious thing for a law student there.
Okay. What now, being the president of that, you know, you coming out of there, you can be a big-time lawyer for corporations and different things. What prompted him really to be more involved in politics?
That's a good question, Eric. You know, when he went off to Harvard Law School, he was a little bit older than many of the other law students. He'd already been out of college for 5 years, two years in New York working, and then 3 years in Chicago as a community organizer. And he really went to Harvard Law School not to become a lawyer or a judge or any of those types of professions, a corporate lawyer, but to prepare himself for a life in politics. That's what he thought he needed the training to get the understanding of the levers of power by studying the law. And so he went there with that purpose in mind. That's why I end this book, which is the first volume, with him driving off to Harvard Law School, because at that point, after 3 years in Chicago, he'd really figured out what he wanted to do with his life, and it was to get into politics.
I don't want to grossly oversimplify things with this question, and you'll
sure.
understand that as I ask it, but another interesting difference between Obama and, say, Bill Clinton is that Clinton seems to enjoy the politics for themselves, whereas my sense is that for Barack Obama, politics is a means to an end. If there were some other way to achieve the things he thinks are important, perhaps he would not have gone into politics.
Chris, I don't think that's an oversimplification too much. I think it's very true. I think that Bill Clinton, first of all, has a deep need for people. You know, in high school, he'd even invite a friend over to watch him do a crossword puzzle. He couldn't stand to be alone. And that need for people translates into a political skill.
Mm-hmm.
Barack Obama does not need people in that sense. And so he's not as good of a schmoozer, and he's not as good at transactional politics. That's not to say he's a bad politician. He can be, you know, as we've seen, he can be a very stirring orator at times, and you know, and charming, but when he wants to be, but it's not something that he necessarily likes to do or has to do. So he doesn't have that same primordial urge for it. He's a little more ambivalent in that sense, and I think that comes across to people at times.
Does that also play into his personal relationships? If he doesn't need people in quite the same way,
it has. You know, in my book, one of his girlfriends in New York, Genevieve Cook, kept a journal, and I've got it in the book, and she writes about what she called the veil that was separated between her boyfriend and the outside world and her, and it was very hard for her to penetrate or for people to penetrate. He was very guarded. Now, there are a lot of reasons for that, and one of them is that he doesn't have that same need to be loved as Bill Clinton would have. But also, you know, being biracial, he learned from an early age how to negotiate different worlds cautiously and hold some things back. And even from his environments, you can see some of that. Hawaii, there was a saying, cool head main thing, you know, just be cool. Hmm. Don't show too much. And Indonesia, where he was spent a few of his formative years, is a very reserved culture. So I think some of it comes from the environment, some from the factors of his racial composition, and then there are other personality traits that just, who knows where they come from, but that's him.
He's unique for an African-American in that, of course, he didn't choose his race, but he did sort of choose for himself a racial identity as a black man. Can you talk about what he decided he would sort of include from his life to that point in his early adulthood and what he would let go of and what he would add to his life?
Well, it's a real interesting arc that he followed, but and there are two different arcs. One is the personal one, and one is the political one. It personally, his story is an arc toward home, which is an arc toward a life as an African American. Born with that skin color, having to teach himself and learn the culture of African American culture, and a very long transition where essentially, you know, he'd grown up in a white world, and even in his New York years, in his early 20s. His girlfriends could see him struggling with that transition, and those girlfriends were white. But one of them, Genevieve Cook, who I mentioned earlier, wrote in her journal that she could see there was a strong, vivacious, intelligent black woman waiting for him out there. Hmm. And that's really what he needed.
Let me have you stop here because we need to take a quick break, and I want to hear about that political arc in a moment. David Marinus is my guest. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning associate editor for The Washington Post, who is also author of the new book, Barack Obama, The Story. If you'd like to join this conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David Marinus. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning associate editor for The Washington Post, who is also author of the new book, Barack Obama, The Story. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. And David, you were about to tell us about the sort of political arc that Barack Obama's embrace of his African-American identity took.
Yes, well, politically, it wasn't as stark of a choice in terms of African-American identity. I mean, he did find that personally. But politically, I found a letter that he wrote when he was 22 years old describing the choices that so many of his friends were making from high school and college and afterwards, finding comfortable niches in their life, both sort of in terms of professions and friendships and communities and races and so on. And he said that he discovered with himself that in the largest sense, he didn't want to be trapped in one of those. To feel whole, he had to try to embrace it all. And I think that letter that he wrote in 1982 is kind of an early iteration of the convention speech in 2004 by which we all got to know him, where he tried to present himself as sort of representing the universality and commonality of the American experience, which really propelled him to the White House in some ways and has also been a matter of frustration since then. So I think that the arc of his political career was to try to find a way to embrace it all and represent something larger, whereas personally, he decided, made the choice that he would live his life as an African American.
It's an interesting the fact that you mention not wanting to feel trapped for Barack Obama, and you also mentioned that same characteristic in his mother and his grandmother.
Yes.
Do you feel like some of his refusal to be labeled by others has to do with the way that they influenced him?
No doubt. Yes, I think that they influenced a lot about him, but of course they were. You know, only he and his family had the racial characteristic of being biracial, so he had his own unique situation to deal with. But I think that sensibility of not wanting to be confined is something that you can see, a thread that you can see running through his grandmother and his mother.
What happened at Occidental College that caused him to go from being Barry to being Barack?
Well, it was actually a slow transition, and many of his friends at Occidental continued to call him Barry, but there were a few friends there. One was an African from Ghana, Kofi Manu, who knew that his name was Barack and liked to call him that, and another African-American friend, Eric Moore, who liked that name. I think it's common for young people in college to sort of go back and search for their roots. The interesting thing about Barack is that his father was never Barack. He always pronounced it in the British way, Barack. So President Obama was the first one in his family to go by Barack in that sense.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Ken in Plano. Hello, Ken.
Yes, hi. Let me just start with a comment. You know, there were reasons to hate Nixon. There were reasons to hate Roosevelt. There were reasons to hate Hoover. But I'll never understand, and I was hoping you can sort of tell us, what it was about this man that brought about instantaneous vitriolic hatred.
You know, Ken, that's an excellent question, and I've dealt with that issue actually going back to Bill Clinton, who was also hated to some degree. But I think that in the Clinton era, I would get nasty reports by fax machine. And I think that now with the technology spreading, that sort of stories about Obama, mythological negative stories, can be spread so quickly to millions of people because of the social networking. But that doesn't explain the hatred to begin with. It just explains why we hear it so much. In my, I've thought about that a lot, and I think that it has to do with demographic change and fears about race. And I think that more than anything else explains the level of vitriol that a fairly steady percentage. It's not a majority by any means, but the hatred is there, and I see it every day. Believe me, I feel it because of what I've written.
So it's definitely your sense that the hatred is more vehement for Barack Obama than, say, George Bush before him. I mean, there's always someone.
I think we live in a pretty unhealthy political culture right now.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, I was almost hesitant to write this book because of that. Because I knew that I'd be trying to write a serious historical biography in a culture where everything is viewed through an ideological lens of whether it helps you tear someone apart or support them. And that's not what serious history is supposed to be. It's supposed to be, a common sense presentation and analysis of the facts. I think there's a lot of that vitriol that's increased over the last, it's always been there to some degree going back to Jefferson and Adams in that day, but as I said, I think the technology's increased it, and we're in a particularly unhealthy climate these days.
What qualities drew him to people as a young man, people he considered friends or mentors?
Well, he was very at ease with himself, funny, smart, and sort of had a hip coolness to him. And he was open to a lot of different people. He wasn't a bully in any sense, and he was sort of often most sensitive to people that he thought needed it the most. So I think that he had many qualities that attracted him.
That's fantastic insight. I was actually also, though, interested in how he decided he wanted to be friends with someone. Did you notice a pattern in the people that he became close to?
Well, to some degree, when he got to college, there was the first cohort of fellow African Americans there. But he wasn't close to too many of them. He was still sort of learning his way in that regard, and many of them came from Compton and the inner city and just had a different cultural approach than he did that he wasn't comfortable with yet. His closest friends during that era were actually Pakistanis and Indians, who, like him, had sort of an internationalist sensibility, a global perspective, and were neither black nor white. In one way. So I think those were his closest friends during his early adulthood.
Do you sense that there was a time in his life when, perhaps after thinking about this for some time, he began to recognize his outsiderness as an advantage rather than as solely a source of sort of loneliness and discomfort?
I think he always viewed it both ways.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that he was ever lacking for self-confidence. And nor lacking a sense that he was perceptive. He's always had a striking self-confidence, and was confident enough to write a memoir at a fairly early age. So he certainly turned it to his advantage. But I think that over the course of those years when he was finding his identity, that only intensified.
Of course, he did write the memoir and another book. I wonder, though, how serious were his sort of aspirations, fully literary aspirations, that might be his life as a writer?
You know, I think that he at first was serious about it, and I think that he will be a writer again when he's done being president, to the degree that he'll write several books. I think that his aspirations were as a fiction writer, and I don't know that he had the talent there, but if just by reading his letters one can see his facility with words.
Do you hear the sort of tone that we now know very well in his writing? Can you sort of imagine him speaking those words?
You know, his oratory is different from his writing.
Mm-hmm.
And he really learned his rhetoric from the preachers on the south side of Chicago. For those 3 years that he was a community organizer, every Sunday he'd go to a different church on the south side, an African-American church, and it was really like a graduate school for him. And one of the preachers that I interviewed said that when he first got there, he wasn't very good at public speaking, but that he learned it, and that's where he learned it. So I think that's a different rhythm and different vocabulary than he uses in his writing.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Rhonda in Murphy. Hi, Rhonda.
Yes, hi. I would just like to say that I don't think that President Obama really had a choice in terms of whether or not he was going to be African-American, because he's African and American. But when you look at him, if he was not the president, for instance, when I first saw him giving the Democratic speech back in 2006, I think it was, I was not at any point confused that he was not a black man.
That's a very good point, Rhonda, and I know exactly what you're saying. Particularly in terms of the color of his skin, he's always, of course, been a black man. What I'm saying is that he grew up with a white mother and white grandparents, and his friends were predominantly white or Pakistani or internationalist for much of his young adulthood, and he consciously was making a choice that he wanted to live an African American life, and he wasn't going to stay with any of his white girlfriends. That's basically what I meant.
So what does the fact that Barack Obama is where he is, what does that say about the history of this country and the future of this country in particular?
Well, I think it's an enormous statement. No matter what one thinks of him as president of the United States, that he was elected is an enormous statement of this country. And to the extent that some African Americans have even written that they fear that his election actually hurt them because people assume that the struggle is over.
Yeah, like we're done with racism.
Yeah, which is not true and will not be true for a long time. One likes to think that you know, in the ascent of humankind, that every generation improves on the last one in terms of race. And I think there are some signs of that. I think that in one sense, Obama was from the last generation where he really had to sort of make that choice that Rhonda was talking about in terms of being a biracial kid. There's so many more of them now and more comfortable dealing in the different worlds and not making that choice in the same way. And I think that there are many more pioneers who are coming, but I think that, you know, even though there have been many books written about Barack Obama, there will be hundreds of more over the next century because of what he did.
In choosing to end your telling of his life story at the point at which he is heading off to law school, are you saying that you think that his early years were more important in who he ultimately became, or simply that the other parts of the story are better told?
Neither. I mean, I'm writing a second volume.
Okay.
but I will confess that these are the parts of the story that drew me into it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every author has their own particular interests and obsessions. And even though I'm considered a political writer, politics is sometimes the least interesting thing to me. I'm more interested in the forces that shape human beings.
What do you learn about him when you talk to him one-on-one that we, as members of the general public, don't see?
That's hard to say. I mean, he was very, I've dealt with a lot of politicians over the years. He was fairly direct. When I'd interview Bill Clinton, if he didn't want to answer a question, he could filibuster it for an hour brilliantly without taking a breath or without letting me get in another question. President Obama was not like that. He was more addressing each question fairly earnestly, sometimes a little bit defensively. But that's understandable in a relationship like a biographer and subject. He had a sense of humor. He's a jock, and I've written about sports before. So the first 10 minutes of our conversation were about the Packers and Bears. He's a Bears fan, and I wrote a book about the Packers, about Vince Lombardi. He's got a writer's sensibility. I don't know if that always comes through in his presidency, but he's very interested in writing.
Journalist David Marinus is associate editor for The Washington Post and author of the new book, Barack Obama, The Story. David, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks for your time.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. If you want to find out about upcoming programs or download the free daily podcast, you can go online to kera.org/think. Any questions, comments, or suggestions can be emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.